WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, very Charlie good. Becker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Yes, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening. My name is Kevin Tachi, and you are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9. WATD World Wide Web, 959WATD.com. And we got a great show lined up for you on what would have been Elvis Presley's 83rd birthday. And I believe it's actually the youngest Headland's 8th birthday. So put those in contrast. And joining me in studio for the first hour of the program is the prodigal son has returned back to the fold. None other than his the man who knows everything about flood insurance and then some, Mr. Joe Rossi. Joe, of course, the chairman of the Marshfield Coast Citizens Coastal Coalition.
There you go.
And he's here to chat. He's going to duck out the door at 7 o'clock as he's going to be joining another board.
Yes.
So we'll look forward to that. Joe, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
And it's, you see, we kept you in the intro.
I was happy to hear that.
We didn't cut you out, even though you're kind of taking a little bit of a dig at me. It's all good. It was all fun. We even kept the former senator, current mayor of Weymouth, Bob Headland, in there as well.
That's right. That's right.
We got a great show. Joe, of course, is going to be here to chat with us a little bit about, anybody who watched the storm unfold last Thursday. Anybody who is a resident in a coastal area probably wants to hear some of what Joe has to say in regards to the importance of flood insurance claims. Joe has appeared on probably every Boston TV station on Thursday and Friday?
Yeah, and I was on TV and will be today on NBC, and I'm on the front page of the Ledger with my...
Wanted?
Yes. Okay. It's not for the usual reasons.
Right.
With my committee member, Doris Creary, about a great story about the storm. So pick up today's Ledger.
Absolutely. But we'll discuss in detail in regards to some of the important things to folks. I mean, we're just getting into the full throngs of winter.
That's right. And that's
having
exactly. Yeah. And the fact that we're only in the beginning is a little concerning.
It's only just begun. Just like the Carpenters.
That's right.
Once sang much better than I just attempted to do. But prior to Joe having a little bit of a conversation regarding flood insurance and the importance, we'll speak with Beth Lindstrom. Beth is a U.S. Senate candidate. She actually levied a little bit of a blast at U.S. Senator Lizzie Warren in regards to the tax reform bill that's being signed by President Donald Trump. And wants to know if, in fact, that the Dems, if they happen to gain control of the Senate or of Congress, will they roll back those taxes or roll back that reform? We'll talk with her about, we'll get to know Beth and a little bit about her campaign. Like I said, Joe will be joining us. And then at 7 o'clock, we will speak with Harlan Ullman, who's the author of Anatomy of Failure. Now, we're not necessarily going to be talking about his books, that he's an author. But we're going to talk a little bit about what if Hillary Clinton was elected the 45th president of the United States? Now, of course, this is hypothetical, but we're going to have a discussion about that. Joining us to have that discussion will be State Representative and U.S. Senate candidate himself, Jeff Diehl. He'll be here in studio. Be fantastic. And then we are going to speak with Allison Arngrim. Allison is the author of not only a book, but now it's out on audiobook, and it's a worldwide phenomenon, a one-person show, Confession of a Prairie Bitch. That's right. Now, Allison, let's see who knows who Allison Arngrim is. Larry, you want to take a try? Of course, I'm.
Are we talking about Little House?
Yes. See that? She was Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie. I know it was eons ago when wholesome television used to be on, but we'll get to speak a little bit with Allison.
Hey, it's Jeffrey from Brennan's Smoke Shop. I want to wish all of our very good customers and friends a happy, healthy, and safe new year. I'd also like to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your continued patronage of our small business here on the South Shore. Without the support from this most excellent community of people, our small business couldn't survive this highly regulated, highly taxed industry. From all of us at Brennan's Smoke Shop, thank you. In return for your patronage, it is our commitment to you to stand up and fight for your rights, freedoms, and liberties this year and every year. Infinity plus infinity plus infinity plus infinity. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island in New Bedford. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the very best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. And our first guest is a mom, a wife, and a small business owner. And according to her website, her proudest accomplishment is raising a family of three boys, along with her husband, Ray. Beth Lindstrom is looking for your vote, as she wants to be the next U.S. Senator. Beth is on the line. Beth, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Hey, thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Folks who may or may not know who you are, tell us about yourself. Sure. And your beginnings in politics.
Sure. Thank you so much. Well, as I start off, I will say I view myself as a common sense Republican, and I have not run for political office before and not held elective office. But I have had a long career in and out of politics and also government, as well as I've been involved in four startup companies, and I'm currently a small business owner. So just to go back to some of the politics that I've been involved in, I started in 1987 at the Republican State Party, worked there for 3 years and helped elect Bill Weld, Paul Flucci, Joe Malone, and the important thing is we had enough state senators elected that we were able to have Governor Weld sustain his veto, which was very important when we had the Democrat-controlled legislature. I've also been an advisor to Governor Romney on his gubernatorial campaign and ran Scott Brown's first race, and most recently was president of a super PAC called Commonwealth Future, which helped our Governor Baker get elected. And I've also been the director of the lottery. I was there for 7 years, and I was the first female executive director, and was served on Governor Romney's cabinet as his consumer affairs and business regulation director.
What do you feel are going to be some of the top issues you're going to have to discuss and tackle? What are you hearing from the residents here in the Commonwealth that they are concerned about these days?
Well, I think everyone is always concerned about the economy and jobs and making sure that people can provide for their families and put food on the table. And that's something that we always have to watch. I mean, we've got great industries here in Massachusetts, but that's something that you always have to make sure that the policies are directed, for example, the tax reform. And I supported that and what the president's initiative was there. And I think that's something that's important to Massachusetts, because we need to make sure we stay competitive, and not only for businesses in Massachusetts, but to be able to be competitive worldwide. And that's where it all starts.
Well, you're talking about that tax reform plan. I know that you have launched a volley in the way of the incumbent in regards to calling out the senator in her opposition of the GOP tax reform bill. And you're actually asking her if she will come out and say openly if, in fact, the pendulum swings the other way and the Senate is controlled by the Democrats, will she work with the other Democrats to reverse it? Have you got an answer back?
Yeah, and she said she would work to reverse it, which, again, goes to show that she's so focused on running for president that she's not representing the people in Massachusetts. And that's one of the reasons why I've stepped into this race, because I believe we do need a seat at the table. She needs to be honest with the people of Massachusetts, and this is a clear example of where, you know, it was Armageddon, the tax reform is so terrible. And so I called her out on it and did a tax cut challenge question to her, because we've been hearing that there are companies now that are raising wages and paying bonuses and committing to more charitable giving and investment planning. You know, tax cuts stimulates the economy. It just does. We can't go on being the highest tax rate in the world and be competitive. Let me give you an example, just to go back. Last month I focused on the medical device tax, where that was a 2.3% tax on revenue for our medical device industry, which is huge. There's about 3 states in the country that have large industries. We have about 480 companies in Massachusetts, 200 of which have less than 10 employees. And that 2.3% tax really mattered. I sat with a gentleman the other night who is an HR consultant for medical device, and he said, you know, Beth, this is the difference between now us having those 600 jobs in the United Kingdom versus over here. So these are real jobs for Massachusetts. And Senator Warren just seems to believe that that doesn't matter, because I think she's talking to her national liberal constituents and looking toward the next step on the political ladder.
I have joining me, he's in studio for the first hour, he's kind of a co-host, but he's also going to be following you. You'll be his lead. You'll be leading into his segment. Mm-hmm. None other than Mr. Joe Rossi, who is the chairman of the Marshfield Citizens Coastal Coalition, and he's kind of the authority when it comes to flood insurance. Joe, would you like to ask a question?
Sure. I, too, have been involved in Massachusetts politics in the past, and one of the big struggles with any campaign are identifying some of the political and campaign challenges down the road, whether it be financial or, rallying a base or whatever it might be. What do you see as some of the big challenges you have ahead of you and how you're addressing them in trying to win against what would seem to be, anyways, a very popular U.S. senator here in Massachusetts?
Sure. I think that she has a following, but I think that given, as I said before, that she has her sights on a national job, that people are going to say, hey, you know, what about us? And what happens to us, and how are we represented? In the past tax debate, where there was not one Republican representative from a high tax state that could have said, hey, here's the price of my vote so that we could get X, Y, and Z. And I think that, you know, with her having her sights and always being so hyperpartisan, she can't work with anybody down in D.C. We need someone who's going to be able to work with people across the aisle, which I have done in the past, certainly at Consumer Affairs and introducing the start of competition to the auto insurance market. You have to be able to do that to make progress and to be able to get results for the voters.
Being somebody who understands small business, what are some of the things that you feel you'll be able to represent down in D.C. when it comes to bringing the bacon home for small businesses and for folks who are trying to provide employment?
Well, first of all, I having a small business, I have to meet a payroll, and I know our current senator does not have that experience. So, and to understand what the fixed costs are of your business and the regulations so that you can pay your bills at the end of the month. You know, these are jobs, and how do we create an environment to make sure that we can create more jobs? And I think that's important. So that's my experience as someone who owns a business, has to pay the bills, has to pay a mortgage on a business condo. I mean, these are real life things that that are my experience, and not also in government, understanding how regulations affect businesses. When I was at Consumer Affairs, we were recognized by the Pioneer Institute for calling out unnecessary regulations to be able to make businesses work better. But I understand clearly how you have to protect consumers, too. So it is a balance. And I think I have that perspective to be able to represent the people of Massachusetts well.
What are some of the, you know, you look, we've got a big midterm election coming up this year. We could see a lot of votes swaying one way or the other, depending on whether or not the president will be able to maintain the House and the Senate. What do you feel are some of the bigger issues dealing with, you know, here in the nation or foreign policy?
Well, I'm hoping that certainly after some of this tax reform happens, that Americans will feel the benefit of that and to see jobs and see growth. I think that's the main concern. But going forward and hopefully having some bipartisan efforts between the House and Senate to be able to bring some of the fundamental reforms in our transportation or our infrastructure, to be able to make some progress there would be great, and hopefully we can see some of that happen. But with regard to our nation as and how we play in the world, I think that it's important that we have a position as a global leader, but we don't apologize for that. And we have to make sure that we are in a position of strength and that we support other countries that, you know, may have some liberties or, that some of the people in those countries, if there's some, you know, human liberties being taken away, we should be supporting that, like the protesters in Iran. We should be able to make sure that, you know, with North Korea, that we come from a position of strength. I mean, I don't condone all the actions that our president has said in terms of his verbal, but also to make sure that, I mean, there are more sanctions that we can put on North Korea to make sure that we come from a position of strength and that we do everything we can to keep that in a position where we aren't, hurting anybody or putting anybody in danger.
Am I to understand that you're going to be launching somewhat of a business growth tour, something called Working Together? What is that?
So one of the biggest benefits, I think, of my career has been the ability to listen to people and to be able to get people together and hear what they have to say and take from them those important things and put them into a mission, a goal, an objective to work towards. So what I'm doing is going around and listening to businesses and say, okay, what are your challenges? What prevents you from adding another job? What prevents you from being able to grow? And so sitting and going around the state and being able to listen to businesses and understand what their concerns are. I'm not quite sure our current senator has been listening much to the business sector, at least so I hear. And so that's something that I think is really important, because when you have growth in business and you create jobs, you create dignity. And I think that that's extremely important to our state.
Okay, we're speaking with Beth Lindstrom. She is a U.S. Senate candidate. And, you know, the other thing I think that is very important as an American, as somebody who lives here in this state where RomneyCare was born and turned in, you know, eventually became Obamacare healthcare. And we know that there have been a number of attempts last year by the current administration to try to do something with the Affordable Care Act. Give me your thoughts on what needs to be done to be able to put something together that is going to be affordable for everybody and also isn't going to be something, when we look at drugs, is something that's sustainable and it's not going to exclude folks who have certain illnesses that need to be treated.
Well, first, I think that we have good health care here in Massachusetts, and I was on Governor Romney's cabinet when, you know, that was being thought of and worked of and planned. And so we worked hard to make sure that most people, 96% of the people, were covered here in Massachusetts. Do we need to tweak it? Do we need to make some fixes? Yes, we do. But I am not in favor of what Senator Warren is you know, looking to go to socialized medicine and disrupt our whole economy, our healthcare industry here in Massachusetts. I mean, that's not giving anybody choices. So I think what we need to do is try to work together to figure out what those fixes are, and that means a bipartisan effort to say, okay, what do we need to do to be able to make sure Massachusetts keeps what they have and continues to provide the care that people need.
No, we did have somebody, Larry, my producer, actually, someone called in and had a question. And it was in regards to the money that the caller says that the current senator gets from Wall Street. Your thoughts in regards to, you know, finances and being somebody who, you know, gains from being in office, you know, whether it's financially or politically.
Well, I think that that's part of the mess that's going on in Washington. I think that that's why that adds to some of the dysfunction. That people go down to Washington and they get mesmerized by the perks and the pay, and that's something that there should not be a governing class. And that's why I'm up for a term limits person that says, you know, go down for 12 years in the House and the Senate, do your work, and come back. I mean, that's what our founding fathers envisioned with the citizen legislature. And I think that's what we need to go to, because people get to Washington, they get the Potomac fever, and they don't represent the people anymore. And, you know, it's my goal. I'm not looking for another job. I'm not looking to run for president. I'm looking to be a voice for the people here in Massachusetts, to go to Washington, do my work, come back, represent them.
Beth, is there a question I haven't asked you or an issue that we haven't touched upon, but you want to take a moment to at least chat with the listeners of Monday Night Talk?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to chat and introduce myself. And I think that I haven't been a candidate before. I am not a politician, you know, although I have helped other people be elected here in Massachusetts. So, you know, I've had a different perspective, certainly from the government, from watching other elected officials, from trying to start companies here in Massachusetts, and being a small business owner. So that perspective, I believe, will help me to hit the ground running on day one if I'm elected. So I would just hope people would take a look at my website, you know, BethForSenate.com, and hopefully give me a look. And even though our current senator is popular, I think people are looking for a change of tone and temperament. And that's something that I'd bring to the table.
Well, we thank you for joining us here on Monday Night Talk. Maybe next time, if you're in the area, depending on the schedule. I know you're the folks who you have working, especially Gail, a couple of the other young ladies did a great job in scheduling you to come on. We'll try to get you in studio next time.
That sounds terrific. Love to do it.
Excellent. This year.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. Take care.
It's Beth Lindstrom, U.S. Senate candidate, joining us for a few moments, talking a little bit about her campaign. We hope to get the other candidates, whether they're running for Senate, running for Congress. It's going to be a big year this year, Joe.
It is. The midterms are going to be an interesting election.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the power sways, you know, and it depends on the tweets of the president at this, you know, at right around September and November to see what ends up happening. We're going to step aside here on Monday Night Talk, and when we come back, we'll talk one-on-one with Mr. Joe Rossi.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
And we're back for the second segment of Monday Night Talk. If you have a question, you can always chime in on Twitter, at Kevin Tachi. We have Joe Rossi, who has been sitting here patiently waiting his his time. Did you have to wait this much time when you were getting ready to do a stand-up for TV?
No, actually, I showed up and they were right there.
Really?
Yes. They call me.
So that like was every shot like had the ocean behind you?
Some of them.
Yeah.
It was
they're
interesting.
Like all,
they're
all perched in situate.
Well, you know what's interesting is they were looking for areas that were extremely impacted by
Ocean
the storm.
Avenue, Central Avenue.
Yeah, Bay Ave, all those places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have family that lives down on Central Avenue, and I actually saw some very interesting video. I got a couple of my great uncles who live down there. And there was video shot with people. They actually had, like, the truck. The fire department had, like, the truck that was going house to house. Hey, yeah. You want us to take care of it?
Well, the ocean there pretty much breached, went right over into the river, which is, in a big storm, not unusual. Mm-hmm. But this one was very interesting. You know, a lot of people have been trying to, and I understand their reasoning, have been trying to compare this storm to the blizzard of 78. That's what everybody is trying to do.
I don't get it.
Well, I think it's because they hear the tides were as high and tides were as high. And it is true. And the tides were actually high, as high, if not higher than 78.
Larry, how old were you in 78? You probably somewhere around my age, right?
I think I was 8.
Yeah, I was probably.
There was 4.5 feet of water in the Venus 2 restaurant, the original restaurant, and the lines were there. I remember standing next to the water line on the wall. weeks later, we had no electricity for a week, no school for a week. You couldn't go anywhere for at least 3 to 4 days. There was no one anywhere.
Right.
There was no electricity, no heat.
Vehicles stranded
everywhere. I remember going out with my dad and picking up people and bringing them to pay phones in Marshfield. And you had to, I don't think, you couldn't get past the DAV. I don't think you can get that far down.
It was pretty bad.
Yeah. I remember seeing ice floating around Brant Rock, big chunks of it during that storm.
So in your estimation, Larry.
And then I remember years and years afterwards, there was still devastation. There was still destruction from Minot, because we had friends that lived in Minot. We had somebody who worked at the Minot Inn, which is now condos, I think, now.
Yep.
Good luck to anybody. But, I mean, they just, all that stuff washed away. I mean, it just washed away.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the article that Doris and I, my committee member Doris and I, did in the paper, were talking about the resiliency of our communities. Mm. I mean, you look at those pictures from this storm of Central Ave and Humrock, those houses would have been in the street if they hadn't been elevated.
Sure.
I mean, they really would have.
But the thing is, when I was trying to let Larry finish and say, so Larry, from recollecting as a kid, whatever you can remember, and seeing this storm.
Well, the thing about the blizzard of 78, a lot of people forget there was a snowstorm just prior to it. Mm-hmm. And that had more snow than the blizzard of 78. The blizzard of 78, I think, was a total of 24 inches. Mm-hmm. And some weather people say it was predicted perfect. But I remember, my mother remembers, and everybody remembers going to bed. It's going to be off the coast. Don't worry about it.
Right.
And it snowed. It felt like it snowed for 3 days. We had a drift over the house. It was the first year that we actually brought all of the firewood into the house for some strange reason. And then it flooded underneath. You know, we weren't near the ocean or anything, but the melting snow flooded.
But the quick answer would be that, would you say that?
No, there's nothing like blizzard of 78.
There's your answer, right?
Yeah.
And I want to get, because Larry would be able to, I could sit here and say no, it was no. But somebody else who is very, he understands this area, and is you find Larry all over the place exploring and paying attention to this stuff. That's why I go to Larry, because Larry understands history.
And what we've been trying to tell people is while the tides were as high as 78, there were several elements missing. The big one was the snow, obviously, so that didn't cause the physical disaster
especially
of snow.
Especially if you were in South Plymouth. My understanding, in South Plymouth, they had 1 inch of snow.
There were some areas, I only had about 4 inches, and I was in Duxbury.
It didn't start snowing here in Marshfield until after 10:30.
Exactly. Yeah. That's
and
right.
then that traveled south and came in from the west, as I was watching people say in West Plymouth it was snowing, and then people in Manamet down to the Cape, they weren't getting anything at that point. So, and then the predictions for that were pretty right on. They said 3 to 6 inches Plymouth south, so.
And then the other big element that we didn't have was the four tides, the four high tides that the blizzard of 78 had. And the big thing about blizzard 78 was, people will tell you, and I'm sure Larry, you saw this, was the tide never went out in 78. It was a high tide.
Just kept coming.
And then was another high tide and another high tide. And the tide, and that, I will say, would have happened if the tide had stuck around for three more high tides in our instance. So there were elements that were very similar, but there were elements that were very different. And so it's hard to compare this storm apples to apples. What we have been able to do, though, is to take a look at the high tide that came in on this storm and compare that one tide and the flooding that it caused to what could happen in a similar situation that replicated 1978. And the result is the flooding was as bad, if not worse, than in the blizzard in 1978 in some areas. So really, you know, what it's difficult to say. You know, a lot of people have been asking me as well, is this considered the 100-year storm? Well, I don't like to use that term. You know, the FEMA flood insurance rate maps are showing areas that have a 1% chance of experiencing a flood each year. So if you experienced a flood and you are in one of those mapped areas, then you did experience a 1% or 100-year event. Now, that could happen next year. It's a statistical chance that each year that flooding could happen. So, you know, it's been an interesting couple days to see what this storm did and to see, you know, people that have said, I haven't seen water here in 100 years, finally say that they saw water in some of these places. It's been interesting. We've gotten a lot of photos. So.
What now? So, if somebody experienced damage, I would think that if somebody experienced damage, that they had already made sure that they had the proper flood insurance. And if they did, well, then there comes the next thing, and that is
filing the claim.
And how tricky is that?
Well, it's actually not that difficult if you do all the right things. You know, it's interesting. Hurricane Sandy was a terrible event, but what it did is it really cleaned up in more ways than one the process by which FEMA handles their claims. You know, we saw all of the issues surrounding the claims experience, as they're calling it, in situation Sandy. A lot of people, even to this day, there are several claims lawsuits still because people felt like they weren't given the proper coverage, didn't have the right claims payouts, etc. So what I would say is FEMA, and I was involved in this a little bit over the summer, went through what's called the claims journey, and they redid the entire way that they handle claims, and it has worked out fairly well. So what they do now is the adjusters have way more technology, and they're able to come in and adjust the claim a lot quicker on behalf of the homeowner. Now, what people don't understand is that FEMA, when they went through this process, said that they want to, as much as possible, handle the claim on behalf and in favor of the homeowner, the policyholder. So they're no longer going to be adjusting claims to try to figure out what's best for the program. They're adjusting claims on what's best for the policyholder, which I think is great. So really, it's easy. If you think you have a flood insurance claim, just contact your insurance agent. They should be able to file a claim online very quickly for you. Within the couple days after, an adjuster from the insurance company will be contacting you. They'll come out and they'll assess the damage. What we tell people is do not throw anything away until the adjuster shows up, because then you won't be able to have anything actually adjusted for your claim. The other thing we tell people, and it's actually your obligation, is to protect your structure from further damage. If you don't do that, there may be things that are no longer covered under your flood insurance policy. And then the other thing is you have 60 days from the date of loss to submit your claim. So if you wait, you can lose out on actually being able to place the claim itself. So you need to make sure if you haven't already, you contact your insurance agent.
What seems to be the frequent mistake that homeowners make when they file a claim? Because, again, if we can help anybody who is listening, who is like, you know, I did suffer some damage and I need to be compensated so I can at least put my home back in order.
It's actually the mistakes people make before there is a loss. And that is that it's difficult after you have a loss to photograph what you might have and what its pre-loss condition was like. So if you haven't already and you're afraid we may get another bad nor'easter this winter, go through your home and just start taking photos of your pre-loss condition, you know, the way things look right now. The other mistake people make is if you have contents coverage, right? That's coverage for your couches and tables and TVs and stuff like that. Keep the receipts, especially for items you keep on your most vulnerable floors. That would be your first floor. Basements have extremely limited coverage. There's only three things covered in a basement. It's your washer, dryer, portable air conditioners, and I always miss the third one.
Cat carrier?
What's that? Yeah. And I'll think of it while we're sitting here. So there's only three. Food freezers. That's the third thing. Okay. So there's only three items covered in a basement under contents coverage. For building coverage, there's more coverage in the basement. So really, for your first floor, you're going to want to keep receipts for things that if you're in a vulnerable area for your first floor.
And which how do they go about? How does the insurance company go about prorating or depreciating? If you have receipts, how does that work?
So it's basically a formula that the adjusters use. And to be honest, I'm actually doing, what's interesting is this Friday, I've never been involved as a claims adjuster, and it's always something that's fascinated me. And I know a lot of the claims companies, or the owners of a lot of these claims companies, because of my involvement nationally. And I'm actually been honored enough to be given a ride-along on Friday with an actual claims adjuster for a flood insurance company. So I will be with a adjuster on Friday, seeing how they adjust claims. So I'll be seeing damage all up and down the New England's East Coast. So that'll be a really eye-opening experience. So the formulas they use, I'm unaware of exactly how they do that, but you're right, though. There is the bottom line is there is a depreciation put on all contents.
You pay $200 for your TV, and it's 3 years old, you're not getting $200.
That's right. And that's the big thing to know.
And I want to kind of digress back to taking photos of how things are pre-storm. How often should those photos be updated? Should they be updated annually, maybe in the fall?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I suggest people take photos anytime something significant is changed in a home, right? You rearrange a room for new furniture, take photos. You get a new television, take a photo of the television. We had somebody at Rogers and Gray who is filing a claim on a building that was recently renovated. So that building, after the renovations, most likely should have had photos taken throughout when the renovations were done. And in between, what happens is these floods don't wait. So if you're in the middle of a renovation project, take the pictures before and during, because the items in the building used for the renovation are covered as well. So those are important things to do. So those are some really common mistakes, is people do not document their buildings before the loss happens. So the adjuster is left to basically look at the damaged items, which they can still adjust the claim for, but it becomes a little bit more difficult and you may not get as much for your claim. The big thing that I want to make sure people know as well, and this is a mistake a lot of people make, is they don't understand the loss history for the flood insurance program and how it affects your building. Loss history for the flood program is based on your structure, not ownership. So the loss history goes back to 1978 when they started keeping records of loss histories, and it follows the building. So we have a lot of people that say, well, I've only owned the home for 3 years, but it's a 40-year-old home. But guess what? It's had a dozen or so claims in the entire life of the building.
How does that? So, all right. So let's say I own a home. I've only had it for 4 years, but there have been up to like five claims that have filed. Say I live somewhere in Scituate in one of those high risk areas. Does that mean that the amount of money that when you file a claim, that it may be lessened because it's a home that it's a property that's susceptible to
repetitive loss. Yeah, so that's a great question. For older homes that it becomes severe repetitive losses, while your loss may not be adjusted differently, your premiums could skyrocket. So what we like to tell people, we would never discourage someone from trying to file a claim. If they really feel that the claim is warranted, then please file the claim. However, keep in mind that by filing that claim, FEMA keeps track of that for the entire life of the building, and it could impact your premiums long term. So all we're suggesting is know your building's loss history. That can be requested from FEMA through your insurance agent or through yourself. And only the current owner of the building can request that loss history because it is considered private information. So know your building's loss history. Know the definitions for severe repetitive loss, which we have on our website. And we did issue some claims guidance right after the storm for people so that they can see what they need to keep in mind during this time.
Okay, we're speaking with Joe Rossi, who is he's one of the few authorities in the area when it comes to flood insurance, when it comes to flood damage. a young guy who has a lot of knowledge between his ears when it comes to this stuff, a valuable resource to have on the program from time to time. Chair of the Marshfield Citizens Coastal Coalition. Speaking of coastal, I believe during this storm, did we not see some damage to a couple of recently repaired seawalls?
Well, I'll tell you that the seawall that went down in Scituate right next to one of my committee members' properties was not a new piece of wall. It was near a new piece of wall, but it was actually an old piece of wall. We estimate between 60 and 80 years old. And that piece of wall did come down. Not a full collapse, but a breakage for sure. And we have photos for people in that area that show the water pouring in that hole. So it really, you know, and part of the story I think really needs to be, though, is that our communities in the last 10 years, from a seawall perspective, have done such a good job repairing our coastal infrastructure, we will worry less and less about these issues. You know, to have a storm this size and only have one, two, maybe three breaks in a seawall across both Marshfield and Scituate really goes to the work that we've done as a community to repair our coastal infrastructure.
I was actually reading something online just a couple of days ago in regards to what's going on with global warming, what's going on as far as our ice shelves, even something to the degree of that scientists might have miscalculated not only the melting that's going on in the North and South Poles, but that in fact that our seafloors are also stretching into our Earth crust. Do you ever kind of research and look at stuff like that as somebody who loves coastal stuff?
Yeah, I do sometimes. And, you know, my thought on that is, look, regardless of what's happening from a climate perspective, we know here that we are going to get nor'easters, no matter how bad or not bad they are. We also know that people on the seawalls and our coastal areas will experience flooding. That's why what we try to do is talk about what people can do to protect themselves. And if people haven't already, please go out today and pick up a copy of the Patriot Ledger, because on the front page is a story with Doris and I where we talk about the missing side of the story, and that is the resiliency that our communities have done, and the resiliency that we have in Marshfield and Scituate from doing things like elevating buildings, building our seawalls that have truly reduced our risk over the years.
Would you be kind enough to take a phone call, Joe?
Sure.
I think somebody has a question. Hopefully it's brief. Who do we have on the phone line?
My name is Joe. I live in Green Harbor, and I have a split-level house, and I have the flood insurance, and the way I have it is a first floor, second floor, because the basement is completely finished. There's a bedroom, family room, full bath and stuff.
So what's your question, Joe?
I heard you say something about the basement is not, there's only three things that are covered in a basement.
There's only three things from contents coverage. For building coverage, there's more coverage. Your furnace, limited amount of drywall, insulation, things like that are covered. And the list is, there's about 17 items from the building coverage side. So while your carpeting and things like that might not be covered, some of your drywall, insulation, and mechanical will be covered down there.
But I have it listed that it's not a basement. I have it as the first floor, because it's livable, as you know, it's a split level. There's only so much of the foundation, and I have carpet and family room and a bedroom down.
If it's below grade on all four sides, it's considered a basement. If it's not, then your coverage isn't limited because it's not considered a true basement.
Okay,
Joe. Thank you for the call,
much.
Joe.
Thank you very much for your help.
Yes, you're welcome.
Yeah, Joe, you get a call out of it.
Hey, that's great. Well, people, this just goes to show that people are really looking for help. And so if they want to contact me, marshfieldcoastalcoalition.org, info@marshfieldcoastalcoalition.org is our email address. My phone number is on the website. You can call me directly at 781-635-5152. Contact us, get a hold of us, join our email list, because the next couple months are not only going to be important from knowing what to do in storms, but also because we have the flood insurance program expiring
right.
on January 19th, and so there's going to be a legislative storm. That's the next storm coming.
We'll have to have you back in
yes.
to talk more about that. There
Absolutely.
He is, Joe Rossi. Joe, thank you for being here
You're
for
welcome.
The first hour. We're going to step aside on deck the second hour of Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Daddy, Daddy, I used that tea kettle to melt the ice off your windshield. Now there's beautiful and pretty crisscrosses and sparkly spiderwebs all over the windshield.
What?
Can we do Mom's too? Can we?
Oh, windshield broken? My boys do a good job.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we are back here on Monday Night Talk. I got to tell you, I kind of like the... Which, you need to know which one is on. Hold on.
Is my mic up?
Yeah, your mic's up.
I'm good?
You're good to go.
Excellent.
Can you hear yourself, though?
That doesn't matter. In fact, probably better if I don't.
How about now? Can you hear yourself better?
No, that's much better.
All right. Just want to blow your eardrums out. That voice that you hear, we get kind of a rotating co-host chair this evening. Out goes Joe Rossi, quick as the wind, and in comes Jeff Deal, state representative. He wears multiple hats. Former co-chair of
the Trump campaign.
Trump campaign, and also U.S. Senate candidate.
The lead on the ballot question in 14 to repeal our index gas tax. Co-owner of Boss Academy of Performing Arts in Hanson. My wife runs this performing arts school.
I didn't say I knew all the hats. I just knew you. I knew you wore
Father
many
of
hats.
Two great daughters.
Yes, one of them state champion,
national champions last year. And guess what? They're going back to Dallas in just a few weeks to try to reclaim that title.
I should just walk away from the microphone now because I was an epic fail on that. Well, you know who I have joining us to chat?
We're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about what happened if, right?
That's basically it. For the next 20 minutes, we have a chance to speak with a gentleman, Dr. Harlan Ullman. He's been on this program before, author of Anatomy of Failure. He's joining us. Doctor, are you there?
Good evening.
So the voice you hear, besides my mind, Kevin Tachi, is State Representative Jeff Deal right here in Massachusetts.
Nice to hear from you, Jeff.
Thank you, Dr. Ullman. Thanks for joining us.
And I thought it would be fun to have Jeff in, not only as a representative and a U.S. Senate candidate, but also somebody who co-chaired Donald Trump's campaign here in Massachusetts to kind of help ponder, what if Hillary Clinton was 45?
Of course. When
did you come up with this concept?
Well, it's always been lurking. People have been focusing so much on criticizing Donald Trump, but nobody's asked the speculative question, what happened if Hillary had won? And having given that some thought, one of the things that struck me was this. First, I think politics would have been just as pernicious and divisive today, in fact, even more so, because no matter how unpopular President Trump is, Hillary Clinton has a very, very real unpopularity rating. Second, while we might not have an investigation over Russia, we certainly would have had investigations over Benghazi, over the Clinton Foundation, and, of course, Bill Clinton's sexual proclivities, I think, would have also caused great degrees of controversy in the White House. So in terms of investigations, I think a Clinton White House would be just as ripe as the Trump White House. In terms of differences, and I think these are the two most significant differences, first, Hillary would not have backed out of the Paris Climate Conference agreement, and she would not be challenging the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran, which I think have been two huge strategic mistakes on the part of the president. But having said that, I've always questioned Hillary's strategic judgment. In my book, Anatomy of Failure, Why America Loses Every War It Starts, one of the fundamental reasons is that presidents, whether it's John F. Kennedy or Barack Obama or George W. Bush, exercise very poor strategic judgment when it comes to using force. And I'm very uncomfortable with Hillary's judgment. The fact that she lost the election, did not realize that the only number that counted, 270 for the electoral votes, to me suggested that her judgment is seriously flawed. So would things be greatly different in terms of climate change and in terms of Iran? Probably. But in terms of the nature of vindictive politics and divisive politics, the situation would have been at least as bad, in my judgment.
Well, Dr. Ullman, of course, the Electoral College was not even a question when she had her blue wall. And so when she lost based on the Electoral College, of course, a lot of Democrats now are saying we've got to get rid of the Electoral College. I guess that talk never would have happened. But actually more relevant today, I mean, we've just seen this economic sort of boom cyclone, or whatever you want to call it, of economic news after the tax reform bill passed down in D.C. Literally that night and for the next few days, we started hearing about $1,000 bonuses from hundreds of companies. We've seen billions of dollars now being pledged to be reinvested in building out corporate America and the infrastructure there. So the fact of the matter is, one of the big things that probably wouldn't have happened is this massive tax reform package.
Well, I agree with that. Also, I would argue very strongly that had Hillary been elected president, the Dow would still be close to 25,000, as the same thing with the NASDAQ. These events were in place. It was corporate profits. I oppose the tax bill for several reasons, mostly because there's going to be unintended consequences. As a businessman, I think that corporate taxation was double taxation and was outrageous, and so therefore I've argued for a long time to reduce the corporate tax rate. But I think it was done very, very foolishly, in the sense that there's going to be $1.5 trillion in deficits that's going to accumulate. Now, the argument is going to be that we'll grow our way out of it. But what nobody seems to remember is that in addition to the $1.5 trillion, there's about $10 trillion in deficit that's going to occur because of the explosion in entitlements payments over the next 10 years. So unless that changes, we're looking at $30 trillion worth of debt. Further, it does not address the critical issue of infrastructure. And I have argued for a long time that corporations should have been able to repatriate their money if they invested in an infrastructure bank, say at 2% above prime, that would then be used to rebuild the infrastructure. And indeed, 10 years ago, I got your then Senator John Kerry and Chuck Hagel from Nebraska to co-sponsor a bill. But unfortunately, we have not been able to do anything with infrastructure, and I really don't see how we're going to be able to afford the money for an infrastructure plan given the size of our debts and deficits. So I'm not sure the tax plan is going to do what you think it's going to do. And by the way, health care probably is going to reduce the paychecks of lots of people. I would also note that since I'm of an age where I can draw a Social Security, despite the 2% increase of cost of living, ironically, my Social Security has been cut way back because my Medicare costs have gone up in terms of deductions. So we'll see what happens. The other point I would make is that the tax plan so far is wildly unpopular with a majority of Americans. Now, whether that will persist remains to be seen.
But is that because of what's being put out there by the Democrats, or is that because that there are, as some of the things that you had pointed out, what's being kind of inflated in regards to some of the returns?
I think that the PR about the tax bill has been atrocious. I think the Republicans ought to be ashamed of themselves in doing a horrible job. I think lots of people are suspicious of corporations, and the fact that the wealthiest 1% are getting huge tax breaks is something that has caused most Americans to be very unhappy. Well, the PR for this tax bill was abysmal, and I blame the Republicans in large measure for not being able to present the advantages and disadvantages in a more palatable way.
If I could ask you, a couple of the things that were kind of picked out, though, if we did in fact have Hillary Clinton as president, would be where free enterprise would stand and where the stock market and unemployment gains would be. Could you kind of give us an idea as to where?
Yeah, I think they'd be about the same, quite frankly. As I said, there are large economic factors here, and the reason the stock market has done so well is because corporations were that profitable before the tax bill. Now, I agree with you, and I agree with Mr. Trump, that regulations are, in fact, excessive. And I think under Hillary Clinton, we would have had further problems. Let me just say that I'm a firm or fierce independent. Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank that were passed by Democrats, to me, were outrageous, and they hurt more than helped. So I'm very, very concerned about the amount of regulation. My concern with the Trump administration is that we may deregulate too much, and there may be unintended consequences, as there will be from the tax bill, because what annoys me most of all is that nobody in the entire Congress read the bill before they voted on it. And in one of my books, I suggested there ought to be a law that members of Congress cannot vote on a bill unless they declare in advance that they have read and understood it. That would be one way to get better legislation out of the Congress.
Anything you want to add?
Well, I covered a lot of ground on that tax bill in a very short period of time. I do agree. I mean, the CBO right now can't score the bill based on what the anticipated potential returns are. I mean, there is $2.5 trillion that's been sitting offshore, basically waiting to come back into America based on, you know, this tax reform. I think it was negotiated down to 15.5%. I know Cook over at Apple was a big proponent of trying to lower that so that they could reinvest a good amount of that money. So I also see a lot of that money coming in that will finally be put in play into the United States, and I think that could generate a lot of the revenue we're going to need for that transportation bill that I know they're trying to tee up in the coming year.
Yeah, but the problem with that argument is that the incentives for public corporations are to buy back stock, because how are CEOs compensated? They may make a lot of money in salaries, but they make huge amounts of money in stock options. And I'm afraid the notion that companies are going to reinvest despite the hype are very much going to be changed by the market realities. That share price is really critical in any CEO and any company's operation. Oh. And so I'm less enthusiastic. That's why I suggested that the money that comes back, if it was going to come back, and without any kind of a tax penalty, be automatically invested in 30-year bonds that would be used for infrastructure at 2% above prime. And so that would guarantee the money was going someplace, and it would also mean that that stock prices would not necessarily be made artificially higher simply because corporations would now have substantial money to buy back shares, which they are doing, by the way.
Well, at least we're not seeing another pallet of $1.7 billion being put on a plane and dropped into Iran.
Please don't even start. I spent enough time in that part of the world. I was on the advisory board for Supreme Allied Command of Europe for 12 years until 2016, and Iraq and Afghanistan, despite having a terrific military, were so colossally blundered by the political leadership, it is almost beyond comprehension. And that applies to both parties, by the way.
Right. Any thoughts in regards to where we stand with the likes of North Korea and...
No, I'm one of the few people, General Colin Powell agrees with me, we've greatly exaggerated the dangers from North Korea. We did this in 1949 when the Soviets got the bomb, and in 1964 when China got the bomb. Kim Jong-un is not going to start a war. He is not crazy, but he is pragmatic, and he does see that the United States does not treat some of its friends very well. I mean, look what it did to President Mubarak of Egypt, look what it did to Gaddafi, and of course Saddam Hussein. And so Kim's view has always been he needs some kind of a reasonably credible nuclear deterrent. Now, in China's position, they don't mind North Korea having a couple of nuclear bombs because that makes life difficult for us. But they don't want North Korea to have something that's destabilizing. And I think one of the reasons you saw Kim gave that speech on New Year's Day, dressed in a Western suit, by the way, and not a Mao jacket, was because China is imposing greater pressure because they don't want to get this out of hand. Now, are there risks? Yeah. Is the regime abominable? You bet it is. But Kim knows if anything happens, he's gone. And so, therefore, I think that the dangers there are greatly overstated, even though they are serious. Now, we're not going to be able to denuclearize North Korea, certainly not in the short term, but we may be able to impose limitations. We may be actually to engage in a peace treaty. We don't have a peace treaty. We can perhaps reduce tensions by reducing military forces on both sides. So there are some opportunities, which I hope we pursue. But this talk of war is dangerous, destabilizing, and I think it exaggerates and overhypes the threat.
Dr. Ullman, again, I'm taking away, one, that Hillary Clinton would never have called him Rocket Man. But two, more importantly, like you said, China has a lot of influence. I mean, obviously, they just gave some more oil to North Korea. They don't want the humanitarian disaster that would be a war, because obviously millions of people from North Korea would go into China. China's not ready to handle that kind of situation.
So I
agree with you. I think it's a lot more hype than what's really going on. But of course, like you said, a lot of saber rattling for him to try to get more from the world stage.
Absolutely. And one of the problems, and this applies to every administration, but in my book, Anatomy of Failure, the first year of every administration tends to be horrible. Just go back to Bill Clinton, his first year. It was awful. He couldn't put his foot right. Look at George W. Bush. In the summer of 2001, before September 11th, Don Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, was going to be fired. The administration could go nowhere. And then he was hit with September 11th. So administrations, because presidents are inexperienced, get off to very, very rocky starts. And that obviously would have happened with a Clinton administration, even though in some ways she seemed to be very, very qualified, having been the First Lady of Arkansas, First Lady of the United States, a U.S. Senator and a very good U.S. Senator, and Secretary of State. But having said that, my reservations about her judgment are very, very, very serious, and I don't think she would have been a particularly good president.
I guess probably one of my final questions would be, is if folks wanted to get your book, Anatomy of Failure, Why America Loses Every War It Starts, where can they get that?
Best place to go is Amazon. It's the best place. You can go to Barnes & Noble and other bookstores. Amazon probably has the best deal, and Jeff Bezos promised he'll deliver it in 2 days.
Excellent.
And where can people find out more about you? Do you have a website yourself?
They can reach me at Twitter at Harlan K. Ullman. I have a website, and I'd be embarrassed. I can't even remember what it is.
I can tell you right now.
Thank you.
It's Harlan Ullman. It's HARLANULLMAN.net.
Thank you.
and we thank you for joining us and entertaining the thought if, in fact, Hillary Clinton did become the 45th president. And it sounded to me towards the end of that you were kind of saying that there's still that even though folks feel as though Donald Trump has had kind of a rocky first year, there's hope for him.
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
We'll see. One hopes that there's always hope. I'm very, very, very concerned. I think I have a column that's coming out Wednesday, interestingly, in the New York Observer, where I write, that's Jared Kushner's old newspaper, uh-huh, in which I call that there are actually three Donald Trumps. One, a very successful, tough, ruthless, smart businessman. Second, a celebrity showman. And third, somebody who is rather thin-skinned, who wants people to like him and rejects people who don't. And those three personalities are in conflict. If the first one is to emerge and he keeps his Twitter finger restrained, then I think there's hope. But he's destroying himself with Twitter. I mean, the reason Fire and Fury, a book I will not read, but which has one revelation that's important, how the White House could have been so naive to allow Michael Wolff in and give him free access is beyond comprehension and just shows the immaturity of the administration. That, to me, is really quite serious. But we'll see if Mr. Trump, who made the book a bestseller by tweeting, if he had not tweeted, I think this book would have been a 1 or 2 day story, but I'm afraid it's going to have much, much longer legs.
Well, Dr. Ullman, I really appreciate all your insight. I know the listeners do as well. Hopefully, I'll give you another something to write about in a year with my race with Elizabeth Warren. And thank you so much for joining us.
Good luck in your race for the Senate.
Thanks so much.
All right, there he is, Dr. Harlan Ullman joining us here, and we'll look forward to talking to you again, Doctor. All right. Well, that didn't go quite the way I envisioned it initially with some of the literature that I was presented. The whole idea was some of, you know, what would we have to look forward to?
I feel like he wants a chief of staff position down there in D.C. Under any administration. He seems to have a lot of real, knowledge base.
Well, this is a guy who he actually chairs the Killeen Group that advises leaders of government and business at the highest levels, including presidential candidates here and abroad. So it's possible, but I thought it was interesting. And again, knowing that you were somebody who, you know, was a co-chair here and somebody who, you know, follows the president and is somebody who, you know, likes to carry some of the virtues that he's put forth so far, give you an opportunity to kind of sit in and kind of chew on some of the stuff he was going to put forth.
Well, we never touched on deep state stuff. You know, the fact that the FBI, we sort of saw how they covered up a lot of Clinton things. I mean, I don't think he really...
But that's coming back around, though, isn't it?
...touch on that. Yeah, that's coming back up now. But, I mean, it's interesting to hear his perspective on the fact that he thinks the economy would be in a similar position had she been able to win the presidency. So, yeah, interesting takeaways.
It definitely was, but it gives you a lead-in to kind of talk a little bit about how things are going for you out on the campaign trail. You get a big event coming up on the 30th with one of my favorite former New England Patriots.
Yeah, I actually have been very lucky to have a lot of support from different Patriots. Steve Grogan's done an event for me, former quarterback.
Steve Grogan.
I know. I have one of his.
Why they ever put cards. Tony Eason in? I don't know.
Fred Smirlis has been a real big
love, Freddie,
and now Matt Light is going to be hosting an event for me at Luciano's, which is down in Wrentham. If people don't know, it's in Wrentham, and it's going to be Tuesday, January 30th. So the end of this month, basically, folks can come, and it's going to be from 6 to 9 o'clock. I'm asking folks to go to the website, though, to contact me about going to the event. So go to dealforsenate.com, DIEHLFORSenate.com, and I can get you more information about this event with Matt Light, former Super Bowl Patriot player and Super Bowl champion, a three-time Pro Bowler, by the way, and a very passionate person. He's got the Matt Light Foundation. He has a campground he owns in Ohio. He takes young kids with a troubled past. He takes them to a campground in Ohio. He says he drives his RV with his wife out of Massachusetts with chickens and everything in tow, and he goes back to Ohio for the summer to run this camp and help out folks. So Matt Light's a great person.
Does that mean you're going to, once you are the new U.S. Senator, you're going to join him in your RV, the dealmobile?
Only as far as the Massachusetts border. Once he leaves the state, I stay. That's one of the things that we've been talking about, is that Senator Warren has a proclivity to spend a lot more time out of state than here listening to the residents. I'm committing not only to working for the people of Massachusetts, but also staying in state, including a 6-year pledge I just took this last week. If you go to my Facebook page or Twitter account for Deal for Senate, you're going to see me signing a pledge to serve the full 6-year term of a U.S. Senate, because I don't think Elizabeth Warren has any intention of staying on as our U.S. Senator. My guess is that if she were to be reelected in 2018, would spend the next 2 years running for president, running around the country, and again, not delivering for Massachusetts. Right now, I'm asking people also to say, what has Elizabeth Warren done for the people of Massachusetts? And I challenge them to come up with anything significant in the 5 years she's been serving in office.
I will have to say, though, is that I think if Lizzie Warren is going to be running for president, she's already behind in the polls. After last night's Golden Globes, I think that Oprah Winfrey is right now the odds-on Democratic nominee for 2020.
You think we've reached peak Warren? You think that her popularity is ebbing?
People were really taken in by Oprah's speech, and you know, while it touched upon a lot of things that are going on in Hollywood and stuff, it was interesting. And so I don't know. I don't think Elizabeth has. I think she's going to have a fight on her hands.
Well, I know that there's a lot of folks around the country.
That's besides yourself.
Oh, well, sure. But no, my point is more to the fact that we in Massachusetts certainly need help. I mean, look, this state has been dealing with infrastructure issues for a while.
Yep.
Healthcare is still crowding out a lot of our budget at the state level. I see it directly being a legislator myself.
Right.
We went from 29% of our budget covering healthcare to now over 42% of our budget is dealing with healthcare costs. We've got to take care of that down in Washington. She is basically declared that she will not be a part of the solution so long as we've got a Republican-run House and Senate and White House. The only person that's going to have a seat at the table down in Washington, D.C., is someone who actually helped the president and is willing to reach across the aisle, which I have a track record of. And so that's why, folks, if you're out there listening and want to see change in November of 2018, I encourage you to go to my website, dealforsenate.com, and learn a little bit more about what I've been doing up on Beacon Hill for 7 years and what I want to do for the next 6 years down in Washington.
You've been kind of living a dual life between spending time up at the State House and out and about talking with folks. I know that you got an RV that you travel.
Deal on Wheels is kind of the nickname of it, yeah.
And you're out there meeting with people. What are you hearing from people since you've mobilized?
Well, I've been talking to police officers, I've been talking to firefighters, teachers, small business owners, you know, just families that are sick and tired of being ignored by Washington, D.C., and they're sick and tired of the finger-pointing and the screeching at each other and just basically constantly not working for us and solely putting their own interest first. And you see that with veterans coming back, the VA hospital system not being fixed the way it should be, yet members of Congress have a better health care plan than people who've served our country overseas, put their lives on the line. Their people are tired of that. They're tired of their wages not going up. And yet here on Beacon Hill, the legislators this last year gave themselves a massive pay raise, in some cases 40, and in other cases 60% raises. I don't know anybody listening who's gotten a raise of 40 or 60% in a year, but that's what they gave themselves, all at the expense of taxpayers. And by the way, the cost of the pay raise is about $18 million. That's roughly what we spend each year, or what the state basically gives back to citizens when they do these sales tax holiday weekends in the summer, which mm-hmm. they haven't done for the last 2 years. But somehow they've seen fit to give themselves a massive pay raise at a time when a lot of households really could have used a lot of help economically. So, look, I think on Beacon Hill and down in Washington, D.C., they're not listening. Senator Warren, I believe, is also not listening. She's hearing the call of the White House and not listening to the needs of the people in the state.
Give the folks who are listening some of the things that you're, some of the initiatives that you're working on, whether it's rolling back the sales tax, ballot questions.
Well, actually, right off the bat, I'll stop you right there.
Right.
So the Retailers Association of Massachusetts put ballot question language out there to bring the sales tax from 6.25% back to 5%. Kevin, you and I talked back when I was first running for office in 2009, 2010. I said that was the wrong move, and I ran for the state rep seat. I ended up winning, talking to people about that. The fact of the matter is our state spends a lot of money in areas they shouldn't. They don't need the sales tax to be at this high level because it's making us uncompetitive with online companies and with our states north of the border. And a lot of our downtowns are having a tough time with retailers struggling to keep those storefronts open. Bringing the sales tax down makes us competitive, gives consumers some tax relief, and at the same time, bolsters those small businesses and allows them to grow, maybe hire a few folks again, and keep the economy going in that town. So to me, it's a no-lose to bring it down to 5%. We've seen in states like Connecticut, when they raise the tax rate to a point beyond what people are tolerating,
7-8%,
people move
it's that
out
high,
of the
yep.
state, they move out of state, and ultimately the state doesn't even collect as much as they expected before they raise the taxes. So it's really a lose situation when you continue to just raise taxes without any accountability of where it's going. So that's one thing on Beacon Hill is I've committed to, and I delivered on 11,000 signatures with my Senate campaign team, getting signatures to get that on the ballot question. This reminds me back of in 2014 when we worked with volunteers across the state to deliver that repeal of the index gas tax. We proved that $2 billion that the Globe blamed me for not going to the state level was not really money the state needed because they were spending four times the national average to maintain our roads. $675,000 per year per mile to maintain roads versus the national average of $145,000. So we won that issue in 2014 and saved taxpayers a ton of money. I think we're going to do it again in November of 18 with this ballot question to bring it back, the sales tax, to 5%.
And I want to give you a chance.
I'm sorry, Kevin.
But
let me
wait,
just jump
more.
In one more time. Wait, there's more. So in December, by the way, folks don't know this yet, but the Department of Revenue has just reported in Massachusetts a really great number. We are over $500 million in new revenue in just the month of December alone, above benchmark of what was expected to be brought in for revenue for the state. So the good news is the economy is rolling. We are seeing at least an upgrade in consumer confidence and spending, and that's translating to Massachusetts as well. So I think that going forward, we can continue to give the economy that kickstart by taking more money off of Beacon Hill and back in households.
Probably the last thing that it's politically a political topic. You and I discussed it earlier today. I was unaware that Eversource was actually going to start reducing. They're going to reduce their rates, and you've kind of told me that this is something that wasn't because of the Attorney General who manages.
She oversees rate hikes, but she certainly doesn't induce rate reductions. And who has ever seen a power company tell you that next year we're not going to raise your rates. We're not going to just keep them the same. We're going to reduce your power rates. Eversource is now, because of the tax reform plan, they will be reducing consumer rates in the coming year.
What
That's fantastic.
What tax reform plan?
The well, the congressional tax reform plan that was passed with the support of the White House, and something that I was in favor of. Senator Warren voted against.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure that I was clear here, because we went from talking state government, and I didn't want folks to get confused.
Yeah.
There was something going on here in the state level, more or less. Again,
no, that federal tax plan reaches all the way down into our communities and right into our households with the savings right off the bat.
And one more time again, that the big event coming up on the 30th.
Yeah, come on out. See Matt Light. You're going to have a chance to meet him, talk to him. And that will be in Wrentham on Tuesday, January 30th. Please go to my website, dealforsenate.com. Click on the email info@dealforsenate.com to get more information about how you can get to that event. We will happily have you there.
There he is, Representative Jeff Deal, U.S. Senate candidate with many more hats. Sir, thank you very much for coming in. We're going to step aside.
Thanks, Kevin.
And when we come back, the final segment of Monday Night Talk.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host Kevin Tachi on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Ever see a windshield crack grow smaller? Not ever. I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Glass in Pembroke. Windshield cracks grow like a bad toothache. The reason is, you come out of your warm house into cold air. You reach for that cold door handle. Your windshield is cold. You turn on a defroster. Your windshield is hot. Windshield expands. Not much, just enough to pull that crack along. Advice, check your windshield now. Little dings, starburst, bullseyes. We'll fix them before they grow awful. Just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Be a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, welcome back to the final segment here on Monday Night Talk. And we've got a really cool segment coming up. We're going to be speaking with Allison Arngrim. She is on the line, best known to many folks, if you're somebody who remembers the TV series Little House on the Prairie. It was on air from 1974 to 1983. She played Nellie Olson, but she's gone on to other things. We're going to talk a little bit about Little House on the Prairie. We'll talk about her book. We'll talk about her one-person show and some of the causes, some of the things that she's working on, and also find out about some comedy that she does. Allison, welcome to Monday Night Talk here in the Boston area. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, and hi to my friend Howie Green and all my friends in Boston. Hello, and are you freezing? Are you totally freezing?
No, actually, if you asked me the question yesterday, yes, yes, we would have been totally freezing. But the gods have been good to us, and the mercury made it up to 30 degrees today.
Oh, nice. Well, we were quite warm, but now we're about to all drown and wash away into the ocean as we're having the like monsoon rain thing happen.
Well, but you're out on the West Coast, right?
Yeah, I'm in L.A., and you know that whole Tahunga Burn area thing where we had the fires?
Yes.
I'm right near that, so I'm okay, but I did just text a couple of neighbors and go, so are you evacuating? Because if the fire was right behind your house, yeah, you're going for a ride.
And have they finally, how well have they contained it, at least cornered that? Is it still going?
We got ours out, which was the Creek Fire was our official name. Ours went out. That one, the Thomas Fire up north, that was crazy. That was just continuously smoldering like forever. But now, at least with the rains, we're like, yay, any vestige of fire is out. Of course, now the whole mudslide thing, the hill's going to come down, and what do you do?
God bless you. So why haven't you moved anywhere else, or is it California the place to be?
California is the place to be, and there's parts of California that don't catch fire. Yeah, it'd be more in the city. We're pretty good. We really only had two massive fires in our area, and they really didn't endanger our house so much. We kind of got out a couple times. We bailed for a couple days because the smoke was bad. We're like, okay, well, we could stay. Our house is probably not going to burn. It'll stop over there. But do you really want to be here for the smoke and ash?
No.
So we've actually done very well in this neck of the woods, so I would totally stay here. There's areas of LA. I mean, everyone loves Malibu, and they love those cliffs looking over the ocean. Yeah, I personally would probably not do it. It's dicey.
Okay, good to know. Looking
for my limits, yes, in what I will live in, because I will go, yeah, that's really pretty. That's totally going to fall down.
So I have to first off, if you get it, if we could, let's talk a little bit about your book, your one person show, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. I know that you have the audio version of your memoirs out now.
Yes.
How'd you put this together?
I'm very excited about the audio because it's so crazy. You know, now anyone who does a book, I mean, they're recording the audio before they're barely even done, you know, printing the book. But when Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, the full title being Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated, when that came out, audiobooks weren't as much the rage as they are this year, so I didn't do one right away. And now I'm like, well, wait, now everyone wants an audiobook. What am I, crazy? So we went to the studio and got an audiobook done. What happened was, I've been doing stand-up pretty much forever, since I was a teenager, and then in 2002... I started doing this one-woman show where I told all true stories, things from my life, and did a whole audience Q&A, became audience interactive, and I had video and photos, and it became this whole sort of one-woman show extravaganza. It was quite the hit, and that's when I really started touring heavily and performing in New York and in Boston and in P-Town and in New Jersey and in Philly and all those places. In fact, I'll be out your way again in the spring. And it became quite successful with that. And then I met a literary agent who said, is there a book to go with this show? Now, of course, I'd been sort of halfway working on a book for some time, and everyone had been begging me for a book. So I went, okay, well, now's the time. So I actually had some chance. I said, do you have, like, four chapters? And I'm like, yes, I actually do. So we talked. I showed him my chapters. And went, now you're talking. And wound up great deal with HarperCollins, and it came out, and I actually made it to the New York Times bestseller list, to my amazement.
Hot damn.
People really dug it. I got a New York Times bestseller, and the funny thing is it's still selling. I was told by people who apparently know these things, usually when you have a celebrity book, a memoir, you might do really, really well in the first couple of months, but after 3 or 4 months, they kind of go to the next celebrity memoir, and you don't sell as many. Do you know my book is still selling? Every time I go on Amazon, there's like another bunch of reviews that people like just discovered it. It's kind of cool. And so I did the audio book, and that's gone bananas. Pretty much everybody who bought the paperback or the hardcover now has the audio, and now people are getting the audio and going, well, now I didn't have it before. I've heard the audio. Now I got to go buy the book. So it's just fabulous.
I mean, are you telling stories about what happened behind the scenes of this, or being somebody as a star? Because it sounds to me you're talking about somebody who, I'm somebody who watches sports entertainment. Do you know what that is?
Vaguely.
Okay, so it's like watching wrestling, okay? The WWE. And if you either have a baby face who's the good guy or the heel.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so it sounds to me like you found a way to embrace being the heel.
Indeed, indeed. I was the bad guy. In fact, when I was a teenager during the height of the show and I was in like the Hollywood parade, people would boo and I would do that thing that people who were playing the bad guy in wrestling, you know, when they hold their hands over their head and go, yeah, rawr, to the chair. I was totally going, yes, okay, this is like being the bad guy in the wrestling thing. You are the mad bomber, terrible wrestler that everybody wants to be. So, yeah, I was that guy. I was the evil wrestler person. Everyone hated Nelly. So, and I did. I totally went with that. Now, mind you, that parade where I was getting booed and I was going, yeah, bring it on, like I was the evil wrestler, I did have someone throw a McDonald's cup of orange soda at my head. And it was a direct hit. They had great aim. I was very impressed. And I was glad it wasn't a beer bottle, you know, because people did react. They reacted that way. It was like, yay, Laura, boo, hiss. That was the booing, hissing thing. So I realized there was this phenomenon. I thought, need to get in on this. And I saw that with the fans, there was this really emotional attachment to the characters, and a lot like the wrestling situation with the characters and who you root for. So that was a part of it. And talking about that in my stand-up act, my book, about how people do that, what it's like to be the villain when you're basically generally actually a regular kind of nice person, and what do you do with that where millions of people think you're awful and you're not really, and how does that affect you? And at a young age, I mean, most wrestlers are adults. I was 12 right. when I started the show, and people hated me, and what that was like growing up as a child star. And indeed, on the set of Little House, because people to this day are still fascinated with Little House on the Prairie. It's running in 140 yep. countries. Our fan base is just out of control. I just signed a petition today, people demanding it be run on Netflix. it's a thing. And we're on our, like, fifth generation of viewers, because we started 1974, for God's sakes. But you'd never know. I mean, people are just mad for it, which, you know, fine by me. So I realized we had this fan base, and they wanted to know. They were fascinated, and they always had the same kind of questions. What was Michael Landon like?
Mm.
You know, because he was so funny. Here was this guy playing this very wholesome Charles Ingalls, but we see he drove a Ferrari and he was married and divorced. How did that work that he was so Hollywood? And this smoking, drinking, Ferrari-driving TV producer, yet here he was, Charles Ingalls, and he created this incredibly wholesome, brilliant family show.
Right.
How on earth did that happen? And it's amazing. I mean, the guy was a genius, but yes, he was a bundle of contradictions and a fascinating person to know and to work for. So I talk about that. And I talk about the whole craziness of people hating me and the fact that Melissa Gilbert and I, who played Mortal Enemies, were actually best friends.
Oh, no kidding.
And then the girl who played Mary, who was so sweet, well, she didn't really like us. So instead of Laura and Mary being the darling little girls who were best friends and hating me, Laura and Nellie were best friends and we were afraid of Mary.
Oh, my.
Like, what? It was wonderfully crazy. We had all these interesting people on the show. I mean, we had all the famous guest stars.
Sure.
We had also our crew. Our hair and makeup people were so old. We had hair and makeup. We had Marilyn Monroe's makeup man and Betty Davis's hairdresser working on Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, my.
So we got stories. We were here with these young kids growing up in the business, and we were getting these stories about the pioneers and the original stars back in the day and all the dirt on everyone. So it was really fascinating place to work. So I do. I talk about all the crazy behind this. People want to know how on earth that episode where I go down the hill in the wheelchair, they're like, so there had to be a stunt girl for part of
right.
it. How much did you? They want to know. So I tell all. You name it, it's in there. And then my life in general, yes, growing up as a child star is very difficult. And absolutely there's been problems, and I talk about everything. And people seem to like it.
I have to, but see, you grew through the show. You, I mean, went from being that, you know, that villain to eventually getting married, and then,
exactly.
of course, you have the restaurant, and then they bring
right?
in another little blonde.
I had twins,
yes.
for heaven's sake.
Yes. And so what was that like? I mean, growing, and then, of course, everybody knows, it's been out long enough, you know, they blow up Walnut Grove because they're going to try to, you know,
right.
buy it. So, I mean, what was that like for the final scene where they blow it up?
Right, and that was very controversial. You know, there's a couple of actors, I know Charlotte, the woman who played Miss Beadle, she said, oh, I can't watch that episode. I have never watched that episode. I cannot look at it. And even some of the people who were there in filming it said, we didn't have to watch it because they filmed us all pushing the plunger and yep. getting ready to blow it up. And then, of course, they shot the explosions when we weren't there, when it was safe with right. no one around because it was quite dangerous. They said, oh, no, we couldn't bring ourselves to watch it. It was too upsetting. Because we grew up there. We literally, this would be like if they did an episode and gonna blow stuff up and said, we're going to your old elementary school in the playground where you spent all your time as a child. And we're going to blow it up.
Right.
That's what it was like. And I got it, and I understood it, how Michael wanted to have the most outrageous ending he could think of. Something would really just end it all. Something where they wouldn't, because they recycle everything. You leave the sets there, they're going to shoot something else on them. We just couldn't leave that there. We had to, like, just take all the sets with us, make it all go away. And what in the hell do I do? And so he came up with this rather genius idea of this episode where they blow up the town. But it was also shocking. A lot of people were sort of horrified that he did this.
Right.
And it was hard. I remember when I initially watched, I actually laughed. I kind of got the giggles. I went, oh, my God, he really did it. He blew it up. But I know that some people took it quite hard. Like, no, don't blow up my set.
Right. Right. That definitely was crazy. And you could never go back. You can't relive it.
You can't. I mean, that's the thing. If you say, well, we're going to do a reboot, we're going to do a thing, Return to Walnut Grove, well, they've done blew it up. So you're going to have to write a whole other plot line, something else going to happen, because guess we blew up the set.
Tell me a little bit about Steve Tracy and how you got involved with helping folks when it comes to HIV and AIDS.
Steve Tracy, who played my husband Percival on the show, wonderful, wonderful person, just a really great guy, great actor, so funny, and just the chemistry. I mean, trying to find the guy who's willing to come on a series that's already been running for several years,
right.
and then he has to play Nellie Olson's husband. But you're going to marry Nellie Olson. I mean, not everyone wanted to sign up for that. And here they found this guy. And he was brilliant. And the whole thing was that he was a little tiny, short Jewish guy, but he tells Nellie where she can stick it and, you know, he stands up to Mrs. Olsen. He became a national hero overnight. So Steve was brilliant. He was tough enough to do this. And we hit it off right away. And we became such good friends. And we're friends off the set. We're having such a good time. So when he called me and told me he had AIDS, I was heartbroken. I mean, and he was so young. I was like 23. So he was just, you know, 31. It was ridiculous. And I was devastated. And I said, well, how can I help? And he said, well, I'm in a better position. As he explained, he said, you know, his mom and his sister were totally standing by him. He, you know, had some money, had some health insurance. He had friends who were helping. He said, you know, I'm not destitute, obviously, like some of these people. And I have family backing me up where many people don't. And so that's why I volunteered to AIDS Project Los Angeles and started helping a lot of the people with HIV and AIDS who had nothing, who didn't know, had not been on a TV series, and whose families were not standing by him, helping him out, and really trying to help people, and helping all the people who would call the AIDS hotline just completely terrified, you know, afraid they were going to get it off a doorknob, and back then nobody knew what they were doing. And it was really good. I was able to help a lot of people. I wound up working for an agency called Tuesday's Child,
mm-hmm.
which helped families with children and babies with HIV and AIDS. And that was pretty intense, but we helped a lot of people. And I'm still doing so. I mean, unfortunately, there are still people out there who are sick, who need help. I did a thing last year for the AIDS Project of the Ozarks out in Missouri. Did a fundraiser with them. Very good people. So, yeah, it is because of Steve. I did that, and he died on Thanksgiving Day in 1986, and it was like 32 years old. So it was before they really had anything. I mean, if he lived a little longer, who knows? He might have gone on the cocktail and, you know, still be alive.
Sure.
But they had nothing. Oh, he was so brave. This was a guy who, when they really didn't have a lot then, they were doing some experimental treatments. And he said, oh, I'm taking the experimental treatments. And I said, oh, great. And he said, well, it's very painful. I have these injections, and this is them. And I said, this sounds awful. And he said, oh, yeah, it's horrible. And I said, well, is it going to work? Is it going to save you? He said, oh, no, it's too late for me. This won't save me.
Oh.
I said, what? He said, no, but if I let them experiment on me, they might find something that will save someone else.
Someone else, right.
And that's the kind of person he was.
And that's fantastic. These are the stories that folks don't know behind the scenes.
Right.
You know, and you know, we may see you through that little magic box in our living room as that, that little mean person who, you know, would put Laura Ingalls through all kinds of hell.
I hate her.
But yet you're doing stuff like this. And not to mention, you're somebody who serves on the National Advisory Board of the National Association to Protect Children. Talk to us about that.
Indeed, I'm on that, and I'm also on the board of a minor consideration, which is also preventing abuse of child actors. So
right.
What happened is again, around 2003, I got a call. They're starting this thing, protect.org. And you can visit our website, protect.org, National Association to Protect Children. They're doing amazing work. I mean, you've no doubt, you've seen the stuff, you see the news, you read the papers about what's happening with child pornography and child trafficking and just unspeakable things going on. And you see, like, what was it like Jared of Subway when they came with the van
right.
and the thousands of pieces of child pornography this man had and the disgusting things he was doing? This goes on times a thousand, more than you're seeing on the news. There's thousands of Jareds out there, unfortunately. And there are people who are, well, in the manufacture child porn. There's kids in the house. I mean, when the cops, the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, go out, and they see that someone is distributing and creating child pornography and they go on a raid, they not only find that the person has hundreds of thousands of videos, they then find, they walk in and there's the kid that they just saw in the video. It's in the house, and they're having to rescue these kids. It's pretty awful. And they're outgunned and underfunded and undermanned, and we're doing everything we can to help them. One of the things that we started doing at Protect is this thing, the HERO program, where veterans coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan who may have been wounded and may not be able to go back to their old job, we've got a training program that they can sign up for, and we have trained all of these soldiers to in forensics, in computer skills, and about the whole child pornography problem, and we've apprenticed them out to the ICAC teams, and several of them, many of them now, have been hired. And we've been doing this over the last couple of years, and the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, they are now getting extra manpower of these highly trained, highly motivated individuals who are already really good at hunting bad guys and are very well trained in the military, and then they go through our training as well. So we're helping cause more arrests and more investigations of child pornography and child trafficking, and actually causing the rescue of these children.
You look at what's taken place over the past year. I'm not sure if you attended or if you watched last night the Golden Globes.
Right.
Give me. I mean, this is in that same conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your thoughts.
Well, I'm a little jaded, you know, when the Me Too thing finally really caught up speed, although there was a woman talking about Me Too years ago before. I always say I was Me Too before when hashtag was a pound symbol. This has been going on for a long time,
right.
and women have been talking about the horrible produced and the horrible people. I mean, when I think about how in my early 20s, my father had a management company. He was my manager. My father or his partner, Jess, or someone. People were coming with me to auditions, even in my 20s, going, no, we're coming with you. I'm like, why are you coming with me? Oh, and people would call for meetings, and my father was constantly lecturing me and the other clients, there is no meeting at the hotel. There is no meeting at somebody's house. The meeting is at the office. And I sometimes would be approached at parties. Oh, I have a film coming. You should come to this thing at my house, and we'll talk. And one of my managers would, like, just pop up and go, sounds great. What time shall we meet at your office? And I got to tell you, a lot of these guys suddenly lost interest and said, no, that's okay. I was on some list of the girls who you probably don't want to start anything with because she's not coming to your house, she's not coming to your hotel room, she's not coming alone to your office, and if you try anything, she'll probably hit you. So
good for you.
I was definitely on the list of young women who would likely go, you want a what, and like probably punch you in the face. As a result, I assure you there are projects I was not called in for. If you've got 2,000 women and 1,000 of them you know might actually say yes and have sex with you, and the other 1,000 or 2,000 will say no, but they will be terrorized into submission and not tell anyone, and you can be horrible to them and send them home in tears, why are you going to call the one or two women who you know are going to tell you to go stuff it and hit you? So they don't call us. And it was absolutely, you knew there were certain people. There were a list of people that I know I never met with. I know there were people. My father, he was friends with some people who worked with Bill Cosby.
Oh, my.
And certainly had the ability to pick up the phone and call them and say, should Allison come in for a meeting about the Cosby Show? Amazingly, that never happened. It was just like, oh, no, we're not having a meeting with them. There were just all these people like, gee, shouldn't I be going to see them? No, really, no, that's okay. And they knew, and people knew. They didn't talk about it. No one talked about it. But people knew that there were certain producers and certain stars who had a horrible reputation, and that sending your female clients was taking a horrible risk, and that your female client was going to be put in a horrible position. And if you, you know, had a female client who said, no, I don't care, I'm happy to sleep with someone for the job, I guess you could say, well, you knock yourself out. But, and there were agents and managers who said, no, it's disgusting, I'm never sending any of my people to these people because I know what they're like. And they knew. And it's been going on forever. And I guess the part where I was jaded, I was sort of amazed that all these people actually got caught. I'm actually amazed that all of these guys, Weinstein and all of these horrible people, actually had to step down and got in trouble.
Right.
because I'm thinking, okay, wow, his brother must have been awfully sick of him. His board of directors must have just had it with him. They must have had something on him that they were done with him anyway. Because he's been doing this for, what, 20, 30 years?
Right.
And he's been harassing and torturing, and now it looks like committing out-and-out physical rape on numerous people. And getting away with it and paying off lawsuits. And they all knew, and they were helping him do. So what happened that finally someone at his company said, we're not picking up the tab for this one, and finally said, you're on your own, and threw him to the wolves? Because he was doing it every day for the last couple of decades, and people knew. So one morning, they somehow woke up and said, okay, we're just not covering for him anymore, and bailed. And it all collapsed. And this seems to have happened all over town. I think it's fantastic. It's about time. As I said, time's up.
Yep.
But I don't know what the legal change was that all of these people who were being completely covered for until 5 minutes ago suddenly have no cover.
Yeah, we are speaking with New York Times bestseller, Allison Arngrim, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. And of course, you mentioned earlier how much Melissa Gilbert loved you. Well, I believe on the cover of the book, it says courage, moxie, chutzpah. Allison Arngrim has them all. I love this book and I love her, Melissa Gilbert.
Yeah, I did. She gave me a blurb. She loved it. When I sent her the draft before even done, and she was texting me going, okay, I just spat iced tea out across the room. I'm dying over here. She was in fits over it. So, yeah, she really liked it.
We got to wrap up this interview. It's been an awesome interview with you, but I want to give you a quick minute to – there's one more thing. Road we didn't go down yet, and that is about the new web series, Life Interrupted.
Oh my God! Go on YouTube. Look up Life Interrupted. It's hysterical. Mason Reese, the fabulous Mason Reese of the old Underwood Deviled Ham commercials.
Yep.
I play his ex-wife. I've left him for a woman, played by Erin Murphy, who is Tabitha on Bewitched. My mother is played by Dawn Wells, Marianne from Gilligan's Island. Her mother is played by Michael Learned, the mother from the Waltons.
Wow.
Everybody's in this thing. It's hysterical. We even have Robbie Rist. It's a riot.
If folks want to find out more about what you're up to, because you are a busy gal, or if you're going to be coming to the area.
And I'm going to be in New York in May and Philadelphia as well. I come in it's the Mother's Day weekend. I like to do a Mother's Day weekend show in New York. I'm going to be in Philadelphia on the 11th and in New York at the Laurie Beachman on the 12th and 13th.
Well, if you happen to sneak into Boston, we'd love to have you in studio if you're not doing anything.
I should. And I have performed in Boston and in P-Town and Master many, many times and have friends there. So, indeed, I should swing by.
Well,
my website is bonnetheads.com. Protect is, of course, protect.org. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and everything else they make. So.
And before we go, and say hello to Hannibal and Charisse for me.
Say, the cats.
Your cats.
Well, our dear Hannibal and our dear Clarice have finally keeled over from old age, the poor dear. Hannibal lived to be 21. Do you know how many cats do you have that are 21 years
not
old?
Me.
And Clarice made it to 20, so we have a new young cat. She's two now. She's still such a baby. Morticia.
Ooh.
All black, gorgeous all black. She's a black Bombay, and it's like having a panther in the house. She's constantly biting us in the ankle. She's adorable, but Morticia is the new cat.
We're going to have to get a Gomez to go with that Morticia.
Right? She needs a Gomez.
She needs a Gomez. Allison, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You got it. This year's Allison Arngrim, our guest here. And folks, that's all the time that we blabbed our way through another Monday Night Talk. We hope you enjoyed it. And Larry, did you enjoy it? I think Larry did. He's shaking his head. He looks like he did.
Very enjoyable tonight, yeah.
Yeah, good. All right. Yeah, so I get it like a B-plus tonight?
B-plus tonight, just tonight.
All right. So that's all the time we have here until next week at 6:15 p.m. Have yourself a great night.
The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.